Hello, church. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. My name is Brian. I'm one of the pastors here at Grace. If you've got your Bible, go ahead and turn to James chapter 4, starting in verse 13. That's where we're going to be today. Now, by a show of hands, how many of us are planners? Anybody? For some of us, it feels really good to make a to-do list and check off those boxes, right? I've seen some people get pretty creative with it. My sister-in-law, in fact, has a huge scrapbook-style to-do list and calendar. She's turned organization into art. Others of us get the sweats if someone just mentions a to-do list. Like, don't box me in, bro. We'd rather just see what happens. But there's some planning that all of us have to do at one time or another. I mean, what about holiday plans? Most of us went through that this week. Where are we having Thanksgiving? Are we splitting time? If we have Thanksgiving here, do we have Thanksgiving? Do we have Christmas there? Who's making the meal? What am I bringing? When are we leaving? When are we going to find time to clean the house? I was talking to a friend of mine this week, and she was hosting Thanksgiving at her house for the first time this year. To prepare, she did a test turkey. That's right. She planned out the meal. She practiced cooking a mini bird so that when the day came, she'd be as ready as she possibly could be. Now that is planning ahead. Then there are the selective planners. Maybe you're not a planner everywhere, but when it comes to one or two areas of your life, you are. That's me to a T. I'm not a big planner in general, but there are a couple of areas where that side of me goes into high gear. Many of you know that before I became a site pastor, I served as the pastor of creative arts here at Grace. I spent 10 years creating and directing the flow of each of our services. And our service orders have a high degree of planning, intentionality, organization that surround them. In fact, people who only interacted with me in regards to our services would tell me that I seemed highly organized, which was hilarious to our other staff at Grace, who knew that in reality, I'm a mess in this area. Another area of planning for me is vacations. And I have a love-hate relationship with vacation planning or trip planning in general. Anyone else feel that way? Yeah. I'm in the process right now of planning a trip for me and my wife, Rachel, and I'm neck deep in browser tabs for places to go, top 10 lists of things to see and do, hotels, train tickets, itineraries, etc. And Rachel's idea of a great vacation is the beach. I like more of a mix, some relaxation, some sightseeing. So trying to balance that and put the right amount of activity or non-activity into each day is key. And so I'm what you call a selective planner. In general, I really like to plan that sort of stuff. But that was tested to its limits last year when my mother decided to have me plan a trip for the whole family to Disney World. The trip was such a blessing, but the planning part, that's like a part-time job in and of itself. I mean, there are six-month hard deadlines with openings for restaurants and fast passes. There are algorithms you can look up for which park will be the least busy each day of your stay, with charts for which park has early opening hours or late hours or Mickey's holiday hoopla, or whatever they want to call it, hours. It's a German accountant's dream come true, I got to tell you. But I put the work in and I did it. I had made the most perfect, most reasonable plan for maximizing enjoyment for all six of our family members going to Florida. It was beautiful. And then reality hit. Reality has a name, and it's Hannah and Chloe, our kids who were 2 and 5 years old at the time. You know, there's an old military saying that goes, no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. I know some of you are thinking right now, did Pastor just call his kids the enemy? Hey, when you've put so much time and energy into making a perfect plan, at least from your point of view, it can feel that way sometimes when something comes along to throw the monkey wrench of change into said plan. Planning can be a rewarding thing. It can be a frustrating thing. But one of the keys to remember is that every plan we make relies on imperfect information. Why? Because the future isn't known. I mean, we can make educated guesses. We can do the best we can with the information we have. But ultimately, our plans sometimes look silly when the future shows up and is so different to what we expected. And this is true no matter on what scale you want to think about, from what am I doing with my life, all the way down to where am I eating lunch today. And so what do we do with planning? Do we throw out the window and not worry about it? Do we press on with our plans, even in the face of the fact that what we expect often doesn't come to pass? Are we in ultimate control of our plans? This is the central question James deals with in chapter 4, starting in verse 13. We've been talking a lot about wisdom in the last few weeks in our James series. And now James turns his attention to a certain group of Christians who are making plans in a certain way. In doing so, he gives us a strong encouragement about how we are to make plans for our own life. Let's read the text, James 4, 13 through 17. Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. Let's take some time today and try to find a God-centered view of plans. Verse 14 establishes that the future is uncertain. But as human beings, the future is deeply important to us, both in the short term and the long term. Can we really go through life without making any plans? Is that what James is saying here? For James, the real question is how to approach life when the outcome is uncertain. His answer is to trust in God's graciousness rather than in human plans. Our big idea is both simple and complex this week, and it's this: make plans, let God change them. Make plans, let God change them. So we have a future, and that future isn't certain from our point of view. There are three ways I think that we need to place our future underneath the reality of who God is that James outlines in this text. Three ways to think about our future and the plans we make about it in light of the character of God. Here's the first one. When it comes to making plans, your future should be subject to the sovereignty of God. And I love that this is in James. This book of the Bible is like a gut punch every week, in a good way. It's been challenging to our faith, hasn't it, as we attempt to live this out underneath the grace of God. So I don't know if you've noticed this yet or not, but James cares about our works a great deal, maybe more than any other writer in the New Testament. But this is what I love about James. Here in chapter 4, he makes sure to point out that our works cannot replace the sovereignty of God. Yes, your works matter. They are critical even in this process of becoming more and more like Jesus. But if we're not careful, our works can begin to supplant the supremacy of God. He's in control. And whatever the plan, it should be in response and submission to the one who created the universe. More on that in a minute. Some people read this passage and they say, see, making plans is wrong. I'm not going to make any plans. I'm just going to take each day as it comes. And the only problem with that is there are plenty of scriptures that suggest that planning has a place in life. Proverbs 21:5 says, the plans of the diligent lead to profit, as surely as haste leads to poverty. In the Old Testament, Nehemiah was a God-appointed leader. In the book of Nehemiah, he was appointed by God, and he used a strategy. When God laid it on his heart to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, Nehemiah began to establish and then to work through a well-planned strategy to accomplish the vision God had given. He assessed the damage. He secured the resources. He established leaders and distributed the assignments among them. Anyone who's ever built a structure, from a doghouse to a three-bedroom house, will acknowledge Nehemiah's need for some kind of drawn-out plan for the reconstruction of the walls. Jesus himself left his disciples with a plan to bring the hope of the gospel to the ends of the earth. And he knew the plan to provide redemption for all of mankind long before leaving heaven to carry it through. James isn't saying not to make plans. It's making plans as if we are certain that's in view. This is about being sure of the outcome. These merchants are in the church, and they're boasting of the profit that they're going to make before they've even made it. There's an arrogance there, a lack of humility that James is pointing out. And this is related to the sermon we heard a few weeks ago about the tongue. Our tongue can be used to boast of empty things like wealth and status. But notice, James doesn't criticize them for trying to make money. He doesn't say, you greedy merchants, stop trying to make a profit. What does he say in verse 14? You don't know what tomorrow will bring. James is not arguing against the making of money or even against the desire to make money. Rather, he is against the attitude of self-contained certainty. Now, next week, he's going to get to greed. He's going to deal with the rich who don't use their resources, who use their resources selfishly, and they don't pursue God. But here in this passage, it's arrogance, not greed, that he thinks is the problem. And so what about us? Here's the deal. We have to practice humility when it comes to what we are sure will happen. Proverbs 27:1 says, "Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth." Listen, I'm always going to continue to point out the goofy stuff Christians do. And many of us have this habit of acting like we don't need God. I mean, of all people, Christians should be the ones that rely on Him the most. But many times we pay lip service to God about His greatness, but we act as if we're sufficient on our own. "No, I'm not sufficient. I get it, Pastor," I hear you say. But then why do you act as if you're not limited in your knowledge, limited in your power? Why do you sing "All I Need Is You" on a Sunday morning, but live like "All I Need Is Me, I Got This" the rest of the week? Why is your life devoid of prayer? Why are your goals things that you're pretty sure you can accomplish on your own power? Why do you blame God when something bad happens in your life, but take credit yourself when something good happens? We do this goofy thing where we want control so badly that we'll do all these mental gymnastics to ignore the signs that we're not really in control. And so we can make decisions as if we know what's going on when you and I are so finite. We're locked in one place in time. We are so finite that we don't know what is happening in the next room. Have you ever thought about that? How limited our knowledge is? Most of the time we ignore that because it's easier to trust in ourselves, limited as we are, than in an omniscient God who may have a different perspective from us. On the other side, some of us are so aware of our limitations that we never choose to do anything. We struggle to make any choices at all because we're afraid we're going to make the wrong one. Both kinds of people fail to trust in the sovereignty of God. If you trusted in God as sovereign, if you trusted in Him as able, you'd pray. You wouldn't worry so much about what job to take or what school to attend because you'd know that God is in control and you can honor Him no matter where you end up. Here's how vastly different God is from us. James says, "You have an overinflated sense of how long you're here and how certain you can be about your own ability." He says, "Our life is a mist. It's like the morning dew." What happens to the morning dew in the afternoon? It's gone, right? It's gone. James isn't even saying, "Man, you're here today, you're gone tomorrow." He's saying, "You're here today, gone today." That's why God is constantly pointing us towards eternal things. He says, "Abide in me, trust in me. For without me, you can do nothing good, nothing of lasting consequence. Stop holding on to the stuff of this world." Instead, we often hold on to the circumstances of our life, financial security, relationships, as if they're foundational, when they can change in an instant. And I've seen too many people's spirits broken because the thing they made ultimate, that job, a spouse, a parent, a child, that thing went away and now they're lost. They had a plan, a future they thought was certain, but then the circumstances changed and they realized that they don't know who they are apart from that thing. We've put our trust in something temporary, our circumstances. Only what is constant will sustain our hope, our faith, and our trust. Only God can be the foundation of our life. The attitude God desires is one that seeks His favor, not the praise of the world. Who are you seeking praise from? And can I just say this? The making of plans as if the future is certain is functional atheism. What do I mean? I mean where you talk like God exists with your words, but you act as if God doesn't exist by your actions. We can have a faith in some places, but have pockets of functional atheism in other parts of our lives. When we're willing to trust Him with salvation, but we're not willing to trust Him with our hang-ups because we're too busy trying to fix ourselves. When we'll trust Him with our relationships, but not with our business or our finances. When we say, "God, I'll follow you, I'll do anything, but just don't take blank out of my life. Insert your own thing in the blank. Don't take my safety. Don't take my comfort. Don't take my relationships. Don't take my status." Humility is required. Admitting to God that His presence is needed and wanted in our lives because we don't have it all under control is critical. And the thing about humility is that when it's done right, it focuses you outward on others. Because a humble person is able to let go of some of our obsession with thinking about ourselves and what others think of us. See, it's not that they're not confident in their gifts and ability and their self-image. It's that they think of themselves less. And that, in turn, gives way to thinking more about God. Your future needs to be humbly submitted in light of the sovereignty of God. The second reality of God-centered plans is that your future should be born out of the counsel of God. This has been the implied point all along as we've been diving into the last two verses. When you have a choice to trust in a sovereign, all-knowing God or your own limited understanding of the situation, what should you choose? It's crazy to trust in your own devices when you can trust in God. Verse 15 says, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. How do you know what the will of God is? It's a common question. Well, there are three major arenas where God has demonstrated that he can speak to his followers on a day-to-day basis. The first is his word. What does his word say? If you're not soaking your heart in God's word, how can you know his will? So that's the first thing. But many times there's not a specific answer to a question we're asking. The Bible doesn't talk to it directly, and we need some wisdom and some direction, and the Bible doesn't directly, specifically speak to that issue. I would say this in those situations. What biblical principles can you bring to that? Is there a decision you could make that would bring the most honor to God, that would cause you to have you rely on him more? That's the decision you should make. And so the Bible can still speak into your life, even if it doesn't directly speak into your situation. But in addition to finding your chair and getting in God's word, pray. Ask God for wisdom and guidance. Ask him to lead you to the decision that will help you become closer to him, not the one that would preserve the most comfort for you. Ask him to give you a sense of peace over a certain decision. But ask. So many of us say we're praying for someone or something when we really don't. We're just saying, praying for you. Come on, you know you've done it before. Really ask, really pray. Pray and talk to God. The third thing is to seek godly counsel. Surround yourself with men and women who know and love God, who are for you, but who love you enough to tell you the hard thing. Tell them what you're praying about. Tell them the decision you're trying to make. Ask them for what they think. Don't ask them to tell you what to do, but allow them to confirm or challenge your thinking from the perspective of God's word. Ask them to join you in praying for wisdom. If we're not doing that, if we're relying on anything other than God when we make our plans, then our life lacks integrity. It betrays the double-mindedness I was referring to before, where talk about God is like he matters. We talk about him like he matters, but then we live like he doesn't. Once we've sought the counsel of God, it's time to make a decision. But once we've made the decision, we need to hold on to our plans with open hands, because God isn't done with it yet. And sometimes we get so stuck in the plans that we made that we squeeze God out of it and we don't let him breathe new direction into them. When we're stuck in our plans, we're not open to the new thing God might want to do. I was talking to a friend in my office this week, and they were telling me that they had a task at work they were trying to accomplish, and they had to meet someone to go pick up some supplies. They had their plan for the day. They knew what they had to accomplish, but they were focused on that objective. They told me, Brian, my motives going into it were completely focused on the task I needed to get done. But then when I got into the car with this other person, I could tell something wasn't quite right. And so I asked a few questions, and it turns out they were really struggling. They were really in need of someone to talk to, and I got to minister to them and pray for them. We talked for about an hour. You know, I went in with one set of expectations about how my day was going to go, and I actually thought there were other things I was hoping to get accomplished today, but this is where I needed to be. I'm so glad God gave me the opportunity to stop and to care for this person I was working with. You never know when God is going to want to adjust what you had planned. My question is, have you left yourself enough margin to respond when God prompts? Because we've all been there. You're rushing around your day, you're overloaded, your schedule's crazy, and then you get a prompting to meet a need or stop and have a conversation, and you don't. You blow right by it because you're too busy to notice, or even if you do notice, you're too busy to stop. Your ability to be used by God is limited by your willingness to have your plans changed by God. We need to let God speak into our day, both before we make a plan and after we've made it. He should get the final say. Can we be honest? When it comes down to it, there are many times where we don't desire God's counsel, aren't there? Because we know that if we let God speak into our plans based on the choices we're making, there would be a lot of changes. And so we're cool if he leaves us to our own plans. We got this. We think we have things under control. When that is true of you, then you're betraying a lack of sustaining faith. And you don't want to live out your faith in a way that suggests that there is no discernible difference in your life for having come to know Jesus. You don't want that. Oftentimes, we don't seek God's counsel at all when we're making plans. We wait to involve him until after we're sure what we want. And then we're like, hey, God, this is what I think is best. Would you please come and bless it? This is cool with you, right? What if instead of making plans and then asking God to bless them, you ask God what he's already doing, and then you made that your plan? We need the counsel of God. Your future should be born out of his leading, because when it is, your plans will flourish. The final reality I want to talk to you about today is that when it comes to making plans, your future should be obedient to the will of God. It's not enough to recognize that God is in control and then ask for him to speak into your plans. If we do the first two things, but then we fail to act on what God has spoken to us, James has some very harsh words for that. Listen to verse 17. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. James is saying, now that you know what's right, do it. Proverbs 3, verse 27 and 28 say, do not withhold good from those who deserve it when it is in your power to act. Do not say to your neighbor, come back later, I'll give you tomorrow, when you now have it with you. So many of us falter at this last step. We may be great prayers, but we never get off our knees and follow through with what we've heard. Have you ever done this? Have you ever gotten an answer from God you didn't like, so you decided to keep praying about it until you get a different answer? Come on. Have you ever turned a no from God into a maybe? Or not yet? I remember back in college, I was praying about whether or not to date this one girl I was interested in. And my hope was that God would direct me, he'd say yes. And God kept telling me the answer was no. But every time in my heart, I would hear no and then say, so not yet, God? Okay, got it, not yet. I turned no into a maybe for about 6 months before I finally wised up and got the message. But I would have been better off listening to God the first time. See, when we think of our sin, when we think of the times we mess up before God, we often think of what's called sins of commission. A sin of commission is something we do, a transgression we commit, like lying or stealing or boasting, lust, whatever. But there's another category of sin, and that's sins of omission, meaning that we choose not to do something we're supposed to do. When we have the opportunity to meet someone's need and we don't do it. When we're called to forgive and we refuse. Sins of omission are just as bad as sins of commission, especially when done knowingly. James tells us in no uncertain terms that asking for wisdom is one thing, but doing the wise thing is another. That season of my life where I kept changing God's answer to my prayer, my heart during that season was turned away and disconnected from God because what I wanted was more important to me than what God wanted. But God is sovereign. He knows what's best for my life. Around the same time I finally accepted God's answer, I met my future wife, Rachel, and started talking to her. And years later, when I stood up in front of my friends and my family and I made a promise to her and to God to be faithful to her for the rest of my life, I thought about how merciful God is, how he knows so much more than I ever will, and how thankful I was for all the no's, because it led me to this yes. One of the deepest struggles we can have as human beings is to surrender our wants and desires to the will of God. But our wants and desires are based on imperfect information. And it's the will of God. It's in the will of God that we'll find a deeper joy. It's really important that you understand that. There is a deep, inexhaustible well of joy that is found when we make God the foremost things in our life. And when he corrects us, or when he says no, or when you read about something in your Bible and you say, I wish that wasn't there because it's challenging what I believe. It's not to make you frustrated as an end goal. God sets out parameters in the scriptures because he's saying, this is how life works best. This is how I designed your soul to connect to me, through great circumstances, through tragedy and struggle. The circumstances don't matter because when our circumstances change, what we've been trusting in will be exposed. If God is our foundation, we'll be steady in the face of our plans changing. If our foundation is in our status or our relationships or our wealth, our life will go into turmoil. Not every ending in this life works out. In fact, Jesus said, in this life you will have trouble. I think part of our issue is that we spend most of our resources trying to make ourselves comfortable enough to pretend the fall didn't happen, to forget that we live in a world broken by sin. God isn't a genie. He doesn't grant wishes, especially if you're using God to get the thing you really want more than Him. But He does offer you something that runs much deeper, that will sustain you through whatever will come in this life, a relationship with Himself. And so make plans, but let God change them. Let your future be subject to His sovereignty, born out of His counsel and obedient to His will. As we close, I'm going to ask you to respond by considering three questions. The first is, where are you trusting more in yourself than in God? It's easy to start thinking we can do things on our own power, that we don't need God. What area needs an adjustment? The second is, where do you need to spend more time seeking God's will before you move? Sometimes we need to make adjustment to our plans or scrap our plans and start over, this time asking God to speak into them from the start. Lastly, ask yourself, is there any place where you know what's right and have failed to do it? If there is, if there's something you should be doing but haven't been doing, two things, ask forgiveness, and then if possible, start doing it. I'm going to ask you to take a few moments and ponder those questions. They'll be on the screen. And in your bulletin or on your phone, I want you to write down a next step and then resolve to do it. Take a minute right now, and then our team is going to come and lead you in worship.